to episode 36 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. I'm Jerry Shario, and as usual, it is my pleasure to introduce to you our host, actor, director, playwright, musician, scholar, the man whose dulcet tones were once compared to the mating call of the capybara, Nick Santa Maria.
That's not a capybara. I just got my toe caught in a mouse trap. And
hold on. Oh, okay.
There we go. Okay, much better. That was radio at its finest. Jerry, your intros just get better and better. If you were a Marx brother, you'd be intro. You know what? I got to tell you right off the bat, you and me,
yes,
pal. Number one, my friends, Lon and Deborah Davis, who are two really wonderful historians, film historians, and they've got a string of books that are just fantastic. And they wrote me an email the other day, and I think I sent you what they said, that we may be the two most entertaining voices on the internet. So that's one thing.
Yep.
But I have to tell you, group of really heavy-duty film historians. I'm talking Steve Massa and Rob Farr and Rob Stone and all these guys, Tom Kokinge. And occasionally they invite me into this talk they have. They invite me like twice a year, four times a year, whatever it was. And we were talking and you wouldn't believe it. Some of them are hooked on our podcast. I mean, hooked on it. And we've got some great reviews. So we're doing well. We're doing well for our boys. And that makes me happy. Now, before we get started, I just want to tell you from whence I came. Whence. That reminds me of the Jack Benny song. If you say I beg your pardon, then I'll come back to you. Whence. Anyway, today I am in Louisville, Kentucky. And I am starting tomorrow, I'm going to be a part of a television show. It's a comedy cooking show, believe it or not, mostly unscripted. And I'll be playing all different kinds of characters. I'll even be doing some puppeteering, which I'm really looking forward to. Haven't done that in a long time. And I'll be playing, you know, crazy characters in this show. And it starts tomorrow. So anyway, I made it to Smyrna, Tennessee last night. And I checked into a really nice hotel and had a, you know, good night and everything. And I planned on leaving at 11 o'clock in the morning, which was checkout time. That would get me here in Louisville, Kentucky at my hotel here where they're putting me up. That would get me here about 3:30. And Jerry and myself could start around 4 o'clock. Well, I left the hotel in Smyrna, Tennessee, and standing right in front of my fat face is a flat tire. Now, consider this. This is a Sunday morning, okay? And my plans just all of a sudden went askew. I have a touch of autism, and part of that is that I have a lot of trouble handling when things change short term. Not long term, I can handle that. But if I expect to do something in the morning and I wake up and it's completely different, I don't handle it well. So today, not only did I have a flat tire on a Sunday morning, but where I was an hour earlier than I thought it was. So I was completely verklempt. I was completely nuts. It was crazy. But I'm going to tell you, I learned a great lesson when I had my sleepwalking fall and almost died hitting my head on the furniture. It just made this all seem so unimportant. Not the podcast. That's not unimportant. That's very important. But the changes that I had to face, and everything happened smoothly. It took time. We're starting a little later, and you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just a very good lesson, folks. You know, it's like, don't sweat the small stuff. Anyway, that's my message for today. Jerry, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, sir. I am doing well. I also will be, not anytime soon, but I just got good news today about a job joining a national tour of the musical Miracle on 34th Street.
Playing Gene Lockhart's role as the judge.
Yes.
One of my favorite characters in the movie.
And I am so going to try to deliver that one line exactly like
overruled. Do you know that he wrote the lyrics to The World is Waiting for the Sunrise? He wrote the lyrics in the teens, 1914, 15, around there. Yeah. Very few people know that. So yeah, you're going to be wonderful, Jerry. I'm looking at you now, and just like I'm looking at the judge robe and the whole bit. Fantastic. And he's going to be Mr. Gimble as well.
And Mr. Gimble, yeah. So,
oh my God.
Two characters in the same show. I love doing that.
Oh yeah, and you're not when you get to be our age, folks, and you're an actor, especially a stage actor, you kind of pray for roles where you sit backstage a lot. You still come out for your bow, you get your applause, but you're relaxed. You're backstage. You know? It's nice. You're eating an apple and, you know, drinking a juice. imagine Cary Grant saying, "I'd like some juicy juice. Have you got any juicy juice? Jeez, I'm craving some juicy juice." Very few people know that he was addicted to juicy juice.
We made it to episode 36 before Cary Grant showed up. I'm impressed, actually.
Hildy, you've got to do it for the paper. All right. Wow, episode 36. This is incredible. Yeah, and we're looking at Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. This is not only the last of their supernatural monster films, monster meetups. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, they are releasing on Blu-ray and 4K a new collection of the monster movies, including Hold That Ghost and Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer. So it's going to be across the board. Looking forward to that. And that's going to be next year, early next year. But they're going to start releasing them as single releases soon. In fact, October for Halloween. Anyway, so we're looking at the not only the last of their monster meetups, but this is the very last film they made for their home studio of Universal International. That was for the man who wrote to me and said, "How many times are you going to say Universal International like Jim Backus?" Universal International. I said it normally that time. That's just for him. It's part of my autism. I just repeat myself over and 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 over. Okay. So thank you. It's the sound of the needle going across the record. All right, we'll start from scratch. Here we go. So it's Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. It is their last film for their home studio. Now, they have been there for 15 years, from 1940, where they played Bud and Lou. In fact, they played Bud Abbott and Lou Costello in One Night in the Tropics. And here they are 15 years later in their very last film for the home studio, and they are Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. Now, somebody mentioned, I think my friend William Garver mentioned that he likes to look at this film as a sequel to One Night in the Tropics. So they're Bud and Lou, but they're 15 years later and they happen to be in Egypt. So interesting idea, I imagine. But anyway, Lou was just coming off another bout of rheumatic fever. He got sick again after the Keystone Cops, after they finished shooting that. And that was for about 4 months he was laid up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a long time, especially Universal wants to put out, you know, 17 Abbott and Costello movies. So Lou was coming back at this point. Now, the budget was typical. It was $726,250. I can't find how much it made, but apparently it made the usual amount of profit. So much so, and I was going to save this for the end, but why not say it now? Universal wanted to sign them up again. In fact, they offered them a new contract because they were still making money. They were still, you know, one of the big money makers at Universal. But apparently, they asked for too much money and they could not come to an agreement, and that's it. They walked away. Now, my theory is that not only were they at the end, towards the end of their partnership, but I think they knew they were at the end of Universal. And I don't think they cared very much, to be honest with you. I think they were just as happy to walk away as they would have been to sign another contract. I think they were upset with Universal for certain things that they had done, taking advantage of the money situation with the 8mm films and all that stuff. And, you know, it was just over. And I think Lou, more than anything, I have a comparison to make. Laurel and Hardy. Stan Laurel was not thrilled about taking on a partner. He was a star. He was starring in films, and he wanted to get out of performing at that point. Oliver Hardy was a supporting character in films. He was usually like a villain or a character part or whatever. He was not a star by any means. So this was a step up for him, and he couldn't wait to partner up with Stan Laurel. So Ollie was always the more complacent of the two because he felt very grateful to be where he was. I compare Bud to Ollie in that sense. I think that Bud, number one, could not have been a star without Lou. I just think he was a fine actor, fine character actor. He was not good looking enough to be a leading man, but he wasn't a leading man. He would have been a character guy and made a nice living and gone on. I feel that way about Ollie. Ollie would have been a fine character actor, would have had a nice career had he not partnered up with Stan Laurel. With Lou, it was a different situation. Lou proved that he could be a starring comedian without Bud Abbott. And I think Lou always had that in his head. Maybe not at the beginning, but that, of course, had to enter his head, you know, especially when Bud was slowing down and slurring his words and, you know, he became less sharp. And why not? He was almost a decade older, and that takes its toll. So anyway, that's the team dynamic by this point. I think that they were itching to do their own films at this point. They wanted to make independent films. It was less, you know, they would have gotten what they wanted at that point. But to be honest, I think Lou knew that the end of the road was near. And that's why this Universal thing was not, you know, driven into the ground and they didn't go round and round. It was just shake hands and thank you very much. Okay, so that's the situation at Universal as, you know, they make this movie. And it's interesting because I find this movie to be the boys back in form. We had the Keystone Cops, which is an enjoyable film, a lot of fun, a lot of slapstick, a lot of falling down. And then you had Dr. Jekyll, which was kind of a bupkey. During this period of Lost in Alaska was, you know, the less said about that, the better. but this one, everybody's having fun. Everybody's trying. Everybody's making a good movie. And not only do I think it's one of their better later films, but I think it's one of their better films. And I think it's in my top 10 list in the book. Anyway, directed by our old pal, Charlie Lamont, who brought it in early and under budget. Thank goodness for Charlie Lamont. the writers, once again, they took a story idea by Lee Loeb, who's been around for the last few movies. But the script is given sole credit to John Grant. Script by John Grant. And when you see this movie, you see John Grant. He's back. He's back again. We've got some crosstalk routines. We've got some, the shovel is my pick. I'm sorry, but I love that stuff. So John Grant is back. Unfortunately, he's not back for long. Their history, they love John Grant. John Grant was someone that for years they felt they couldn't do without. And when it came to this whole communist thing with Lou, you just want to smack him in the face at this point. It's like, come on. In 1951, he was handing everybody these, you know, things to sign, saying you were never a communist, right? He was buying into this whole Joe McCarthy witch hunt thing, and it's just not his shining moment. And he handed it to John Grant in 1951, and John Grant said, no, I'm not going to sign this. And Lou fired him. Talk about cutting off your nose to spite Abbott's face. So John Grant was fired. Let me put it this way. He went away and he wrote on Ma and Pa Kettle at the Fair, complete with some Abbott and Costello routines, even a mention of Abbott and Costello in the movie. Who are you guys? Abbott and Costello? He worked on Double Crossbones for Donald O'Connor, where he did the handkerchief thing. You stand on one end, I'll stand on the other. And he worked for Martin and Lewis, of all people. Talk about sacrilege. He went to the enemy and worked on Sailor Beware, one of their big hits. So Lewis, putting his his pride behind him, and got John Grant back from Captain Kidd on for the rest of their Universal career. Unfortunately, well, let's go back. We didn't really talk about John Grant. He was born in 1891 in Tarentum, Pennsylvania, which I've never been to. In burlesque, he was a producer, a comedian, and a straight man. Not all at the same time, because they would have put him away, I think. But that's where he met Bud and Lou, and I'm sure he met Bud before he met Lou. And here's the sad part. This movie was released April 16th, 1955, and John Grant passed away in November of that same year. Yeah, He was only 63 years old, and I believe it was his heart. I think he had heart disease. So John Grant was finished when the boys were finished, basically.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know, it's almost ironic in a sense. So John Grant, sole writing credit. And this movie, I think, has a really incredible cast. You know, for a movie buff, it's really a lot of familiar people. Sexy Marie Windsor. Eyes. Oh, my God. She looks like Cleopatra. You know what I mean? Like the way you imagine Cleopatra to look like. She's got that face and those eyes. Just gorgeous. So she's our villainess, our main villainess, and we'll get to her when we get to her. But in the meantime, the movie begins with a really nice orchestral version of ya da 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 da. What do we call that?
I know it's got a name, and I'd have to look it up.
It has a name.
It does have a name.
All the girls in France like to talk about their past. That's what we used to say when we were kids.
But the name of it is escaping me right now. I think mostly because I was so shocked and amazed and surprised that Abbott and Costello were doing a monster movie. And it wasn't the music from Meet Frankenstein.
Now, I wonder, I watched the movie twice, once with the commentary and once without. And I don't think I recognized any of the Frankenstein music.
No. It's not
there. But it was a very good score, though. It was, it had those that great brass whenever, like, the monster showed up. So the movie begins, and I love the sarcophagus, the sarcophagi. That open up, and there they are, the two of them. And they're real pictures of them. They're not cheap caricatures this time. But it reminded me of the first time I saw this film. It was on the CBS affiliate on a Saturday afternoon. I'll never forget it. 4 o'clock in the afternoon. CBS was down that day. This is what those days when that would happen. Their antenna was down, and we just had snow on Channel 2. Which was a network channel, So I had to go to my friend's house. He had he was the first person to have a color TV in our neighborhood. And he had this big TV. And we turned it on, and he had snow, too. And it was a antenna problem. And I watched the movie through the snow. And I remember, I would see a 30-second snippet of it, and then 5 minutes of snow, and then I'd have 30 seconds, and then five. This is how crazy I was. And I remember specifically those pictures in the opening credits, and that was a special memory for me. But anyway, watching the movie, it's got all of that stuff. It lists the cast and everything else. It's a very, very good score. It's definitely a good score, and I know Henry Mancini worked on this as well. The film opens at the Cafe Baghdad, and there we see the Mazarone Abbott dancers. I think that's the name, Mazarone, something like that. Abbott dancers, and that also ties in to, early on, when they asked Arthur Lubin to direct Buck Privates, he heard the name Abbott and he assumed it was these dancers. And sure enough, here they are in their very last film. But where's Arthur Lubin? So anyway, you have them and they are Apache dancers. I know that's how they pronounce it in France. Apache or Apache. And that is a pimp in French culture. And this dance is a fight between whores and their pimp. And it's very violent. And there's a lot of punching and hair pulling. And, you know, it's incredible. It really is an impressive sight. So they're fighting. Mm-hmm. And who walks in right off the bat, right at the top, without, you know, stupid Bobby outfits with truncheons? It's Abbott and Costello walking in with pith helmets and looking just great. And you're wondering what they're doing there. And we're never told. So, and you know what? I don't care. They sit down and immediately the Apache dancer throws one of the women directly at Lou. And he falls backwards in his chair with the girl on top of him. So anyway, this starts a whole table shtick where he gets up and he grabs the wrong chair and Abbott falls on the floor. So the dance ends with the guy falling onto a barrel full of liquid. I mean, imagine having to clean mm-hmm. that stage every night. Okay, now one of my favorite things in the entire movie comes up at this point, and it has to do with a person who was an original Keystone Cop and was in the movie before this, and that's Hank Mann. And Hank Mann plays the waiter, and he comes over with a shish kebab, which is still on fire. And Lou grabs a glass of water and says, "The meat's on fire," and he throws it, and it goes all over Abbott's face and shirt. And Abbott has to get up and go to the bathroom and straighten up, although why can't he do that at the table? What's he doing in the bathroom? So he goes away, and I think it's just for the gag. And as he comes back, he sits down. The waiter brings the meat again, which is still on fire. And Lou, "The meat's still on fire." And he throws it, and it's all over Bud again. So this is why Bud had to go to the bathroom. As he's walking back, he notices a table where a man is being interviewed by the press. Now, this is Dr. Zoomer, and it's August Zoomer. And he is an archaeological expert, and he has in his possession the mummy, Claris. Now, my Universal Monster Kid people, we know that the name is Claris. But, you know, this was how many years after the last mummy movie, which I think was 45, and this was, what, 10 years later? So they probably just didn't remember.
Almost, yeah.
You know? Well, it rhymes with Caris, so it was like Claris. Oh, yeah, it is close enough. And that's a K-L word, too. K, words with a K. Mummies with a K are funny. Mummies with a K. K Ballard. Funny. Anyway, so
the mummy's in-law? No, I don't think so.
The in-laws. The mother's in-laws. We used to watch that all the time. Yeah. I used to love when Desi Arnaz was on.
Yes.
He was the producer. That was a Desi Lu production. Okay, so Dr. Zoomer, played by Kurt Katch, a Polish Jew who got out in time before the Nazis did their little dance on those poor people, and he came over to America and played Nazis. So anyway, he plays Dr. Zoomer, and he's giving an interview, and he says, now here, this is where it gets complicated, and I had to pay attention. This is the plot. He has in his possession Claris, the mummy. The mummy has in its possession a medallion which tells you the location of Princess Ara, A-R-A, and the treasure that goes with it. Okay? Now, Abbott overhears the fact that Dr. Zoomer wants to hire two more people to go along on the expedition. And Bud hears this and it's like, yes, this is what we're going to do. We're going to make money and then we can get home and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So he goes back to Lou to tell him what's going on. And they plan to go to Dr. Zoomer's office the very next day, which is what they do. But they are preceded by two members of an Egyptian cult that worships Claris and Princess Ara and are also looking for the medallion so they could, you know, go and get the treasure and blah, blah, blah. and bring Claris back to where he belongs. But they are just as deadly as our villains, who are Dan Seymour, Michael and Sarah, interesting, and Marie Windsor. Now, Marie Windsor, back in 1980, I was a rather newish member of the Screen Actors Guild, and the actors were on strike. So we marched in front of, that day was 20th Century Fox, and I managed to inch my way up, and I marched next to Marie Windsor, who still looked great. And we talked, and she was very amused by the fact that this was the only movie that I wanted to know about. And, you know, she said, you know, everybody wants to know about Narrow Margin and The Killing and this and that. I want to know about Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. And she said she had the best time, and they were wonderful to work with, and she had to get used to working to their method. But once she got there, she had the time of her life. And it was just so wonderful to hear that from her. And those eyes, even at that age, she was just... Mm-hmm. Just great. So that was what? That was about 1980, 81. Boy, it was a baby. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's Marie Windsor. But let's talk about those actors. I need to go back and tell you about those actors. Now, Fred Clark. No, wait, that was last week. I'm getting there. Hold on, folks. We have in first position, let's talk about Marie Windsor. Okay. Her real name, Emily Marie Bertelsen. And she was born in Marysvale, Utah in 1919. She did shows at Brigham Young University. I'm thinking she was a Mormon. She was expert at dancing, swimming. She was a horsewoman. She played golf, tennis, and she skied. Now, that's a pretty athletic woman. That's a woman of many gifts. Yeah. She was crowned Miss Utah of 1939 by the Chamber of Commerce. Is that Miss America? That would be Miss America, right? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But she didn't go on from there. She trained in Hollywood. Are you ready? She trained with the great teacher and actress, Maria Uspenskaya. Yes, Maliva, the gypsy woman in the Wolfman movies, among many other things. She kind of resembled my Sicilian grandmother. They both had those flat, wide noses. It's weird. But anyway, Marie Windsor was tall. She was 5'9", and she feels like that handicapped her career because the leading men were so short. She enjoyed working with Forrest Tucker, who was 6'5". So she liked that a lot. So when she came out here into Hollywood, when she came to Hollywood, she modeled for Paul Hess, doing glamour shots. She did a lot of theater in L.A., Pasadena Playhouse, in a movie, in a Broadway show called Follow the Girls. She played a villain in that and got a lot of attention. And she came back to the stage in 1986. She did a show called The Bar Off Melrose. And she won like the LA Critics Award that late in the game. She was quite an actress. So what else? She did bit parts in films. And while she was doing that, she was also working as a phone operator to make ends meet. In 1942, she was noticed by Jack Benny because she'd written jokes for him. She used to send him jokes, and he wanted to meet her. Who is this young lady who's sending me these jokes? And when he saw her, because of her looks, he got her a contract at Warner Brothers. Jack Benny. How about that? So she worked at Warner's for a while. Nothing really came from it. She worked at MGM for a short time, but then an independent company called Enterprise Productions signed her to a long-term contract in 1948. Her first big role was in Force of Evil with John Garfield. She was also in some great film noirs. She was in The Sniper with Adolf Manjou. The Narrow Margin is probably her most famous film. That's the one I'm thinking of, with Charlie McGraw and Paul Maxey as the big fat detective who blocks people in the narrow hallways of the train. She did The Killing, of course, The City That Never Sleeps, and everybody's favorite, Catwoman on the Moon. No kidding. I'm not kidding. Which was shot in 3D, by the way. On TV, she did everything from Cheyenne to Charlie's Angels to Murder, She Wrote to Batman. I remember watching, it may have been even the first episode. She's a reporter, and she's grilling Batman, and I'm like, that's Marie Windsor. So anyway, she really got around. Her first husband was band leader Ted Steele, but that was annulled a few months later. Then she married a realtor by the name of Jack Hupp, who was also on the Olympic basketball team in 1936 when we humiliated Hitler. Yeah. They were married until 2000, which is when she passed away at the age of 80. That's Marie Windsor, but I'm going to go down the line now because we're meeting all of our villains at this point. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about Michael Ansara. He was born in French Mandate, Syria. So he was quite Syria. In 1922, and he moved to the USA at 2 years old, very mature. And the family moved to Lowell, Massachusetts. And when he was 10 years old, they all moved to California, to Los Angeles. He worked at the Pasadena Playhouse, went to LA City College, where he did shows. In World War II, he was part of a medical unit, did very well there. When he got back, he did bit parts from the mid-1940s on. He made a screen debut in 1944 in Action in Arabia, which is a movie I really like. The star is George Sanders, so you know it's a B-movie if he's the star. He was in movies like The Desert Hawk, Soldiers 3. He actually was in The Robe as Judas. Ten Commandments for DeMille, Greatest Story Ever Told for George Stevens, Serpent of the Nile, where he met his first wife, actress Jean Byron, who was Patty Duke's mother in The Patty Duke Show. They were married for a while. I forget how long. But anyway, he played Pindarus in Julius Caesar with Marlon Brando, John Gielgud, and James Mason. So he did a lot of good things at the beginning. In 1956, he played Cochise in the movie Broken Arrow after Ricardo Montalban turned it down. Actually, that was the TV show, I believe, Broken Arrow, where he played Cochise. Then he starred in a show called Law of the Plainsman from 59 to 60. He appeared as the Blue Genie. I have that in common with him. I did too.
Yes.
In I Dream of Jeannie, which starred his wife at the time. And they were also together in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, the movie produced by Irwin Allen. Mm-hmm. They were in another movie together called mm-hmm. Seven Different Ways, and that was 1964, and it sounds dirty. So Ansara, he also appeared in a movie starring one of my dear, dear friends, and her name was Tura Saitana. Now, for those of you who know Tura, you know the movie Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill by Russ Meyer. She was in this movie, The Doll Squad, in 1973. And they say, Aaron Spelling, that he saw this movie and got the idea for Charlie's Angels from this movie, which is very plausible, actually. So Michael Ansara was the main villain. And actually, I believe he got top billing in that movie. He met his last wife on a movie called The Manitou, which is a cheesy horror movie from 1977. Barbara Eden and Michael Ansara, they had sort of a Star is Born situation. During her heyday, he started making movies like The Doll's Mm-hmm. One. so that wasn't very good. They lost their son, Matthew, in 2001 due to a heroin overdose. Mm-hmm. And that was a terrible tragedy for the two of them. So, yeah, he stayed married to his last wife for a while, and he passed away in 2013 at the age of 91. Not bad. And I believe Barbara Eden is turning 90 this year, or has turned 90 this year, right?
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yeah.
She's a dynamo. She looks great. And let's talk about Dan Seymour very quickly, because he's been around. He was in Hit the Ice. And he was in Foreign Legion, Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. But I don't believe I talked about his background. And I don't mean his posterior, which is quite prodigious. So anyway, Dan Seymour was born Daniel Seymour Katz K-A-T-Z, in 1915 in Chicago. He graduated from the University of Chicago with a B.S. in fine arts. He actually worked in burlesque as a young song and dance man and as an MC in nightclubs. He was also quite a radio announcer, Dan Seymour. Did a lot of work on radio. He went to Hollywood in the early 1940s, where he dropped 100 pounds. He was about 350 pounds. He went down to 250 for Hollywood. Yeah, wow. He was a big boy. He did that with dieting and swimming. He played a lot of exotic villains. To Have and Have Not was one of his biggies. He was one of Edward G. Robinson's henchmen in Key Largo. He did lots of television. He was on Batman, I think, like three or four times. Perry Mason. Mm-hmm. He was on Superman. I mean, this is a guy after my own heart. The Untouchables. And he only married once. And that was from 1949 to his death, which was he died of a stroke in 1993 at the age of 78. Okay, so we have our villains. Those are our three villains, and they're formidable. Okay, they're killers. Yep, and yep. They also show up at Dr. Zoomer's. But first, it's the two cult figures, one of whom is Mel Wells, who did a lot of work for Roger Corman and played Mr. Mushnick in the original Little Shop of Horrors. So he's a familiar face. So these two guys with the turbans are there to take Clarice back. Unfortunately, Bud and Lou show up, and they do a little bit of dialogue at the front door.
Now, this is the place. I overheard Dr. Zoomer say he needed a couple of men to accompany his mummy back to the States.
She afraid to travel by herself?
She? No. His mummy is a he. What's wrong with that? Some mummies are men, some mummies are women.
It's a strange country.
What's strange about it, Lou?
Your mummy, wasn't she a woman?
I never had a mummy.
What'd your father do, win you in a crab game?
What's the matter?
I thought you were going to slap me.
Stop that nonsense.
So after doing that John Grant tribute, they notice that the door is open. They go in, and this place seems to be empty. And, you know, Bud's Dr. Zoomer, you know, and they're looking for Dr. Zoomer. And before they got there, Dr. Zoomer was talking into his reel-to-reel tape recorder. He was making comments about the progress of his archaeological experience. So he's killed by the two cult figures, Mel Wells and his buddy. He's killed with a poison dart to the ear, and he dies. They take the body and they hide it. Okay, so Bud and Lou show up. They don't know where Dr. Zuma is. And Bud says, you know, I'll go look for him here. You look for him here. And of course, you know, when they go in, and this is very, I love this. I'm sorry. I write about it in the book, Annotated Abbott and Costello. There is a fake harem girl, a dummy, a mannequin or a womankin, laying on a slab in this room that has sarcophaguses or sarcophagi. I'm sarcophagi and mummies and things like that. But laying on this platform is this mannequin of a very pretty harem girl. And she's got a terrific butt. So when Lou is walking around looking for Dr. Zoomer, he notices this thing and he focuses on the rear end. And he lifts his hand to slap it, and he looks at us, and it's almost like he notices us watching, and he changes his mind, and he walks away. And it's kind of cute, you know. It's something a guy would do. So anyway, we come back to that later, and we'll talk about that later. So they're looking around, and Lou, of course, opens a closet door, and there is Dr. Zoomer hanging on a hook. And we're going through now the Hold That Ghost stuff, you know, where they find Charlie wherever, you know, Lou opens a door. And, of course, Bud gets there and he's gone. So, you know, well, you had too much sun. And Bud actually sounded like this at this point. Yes. So Lou goes to wash his face, you know, to clear his head a little bit. He walks into the bathroom. He closes the door, and there hanging on the door hook is Dr. Zoomer's body. And, you know, Lou's like, you know, cleaning his eyes, and he turns around, and he uses Dr. Zoomer's shirt to wipe his face. And he notices Dr. Zoomer. And it's weird because it's Hey Abbott. You know, it's Abbott. You know, yes. It's not their characters' names, which are Freddie Francis and Peter Peterson or something like that. They just ignored it. They chose something to ignore like it, and I love them for it. So Bud comes there, and of course, Dr. Zoomer's gone. Eventually, they find him, and Bud has to believe him at this point. So they repeat something that they did just recently in Jekyll and Hyde. Bud is in the bathroom looking around for Dr. Zoomer. He goes into the bathtub, closes the curtain. Lou sees the curtain moving, thinks it's whatever, a bad guy, and hits him over the head. And it turns out to be Bud. So, you know, Bud's back in his position of, you know, taking the falls, taking the violence. And he takes quite a bit of it in this film. I like when Lou first sees the body and he runs past Abbott. And off camera, he runs right past him. Off camera, we don't see him. We only hear like a minute of crashing. And of course, he comes back. His hat is over his eyes and all this stuff. It's very funny. And Bud repeats it, you know, not long afterwards. He runs past Lou and the same thing happens. Anyway, so Bud tells Lou he needs to be brave. You know, I'm not afraid of anything. And Lou's like, be brave. Be strong. You know, and he's imitating Abbott. So he goes over to the tape recorder and he says, well, maybe if I hear myself being tough, then I'll be tough. And he turns it on in his recording and he does all those things.
Guess what I've done? And I'm going to use it. Put your hands up or I'll fill you full of lead. Back up. Back up. Back up.
I'm going to see if I'm really tough now.
And he's doing all these things into the tape recorder. Anyway, they turn that off, and Bud comes back. They found Dr. Zoomer by the tape recorder, and Bud says, we better take a picture. They have a camera with them. We better take a picture of Dr. Zoomer so we have the proof to show the police. So Bud is picking up Dr. Zoomer to put him back in the chair, and Lou chooses that moment to take the picture. And that comes back to bite them in the rear end a little later on. So everybody wants this medallion, but nobody knows where it is. It turns out that Lou finds it inside this relic, and inside this like ceramic piece that has a hole in it. The Egyptians, the cult leaders, dropped it in there to hide it. Lou picks it up and thinks it's a piggy bank, and he finds it. Now, before this happens, the three villains, okay, the three villains, Marie Windsor and Michael Ansara and Dan Seymour, they are there looking for the medallion themselves. When Marie Windsor first gets there, he hears Bud and Lou coming into that room where the mannequin was laying on that slab, the pretty harem girl. And Marie Windsor happens to be dressed just like the harem girl. She pushes the mannequin off and she takes its place. And her beautiful behind is right there in front of us. So Lou is looking around and he comes up to this slab again to this beautiful woman. And he's about to slap the butt again. And he changes his mind. He takes off his hat and he hits it with his hat. He had to hit it. I don't know about you. I did mention this scene to Marie Windsor. And I told her that even when I was a little kid, I thought it was very sexy. So this is one of the things I love. And this is the Me Too movement in an Abbott and Costello movie. He hits her in the butt with his hat and he walks away, you know, oh, look what I did. And she kicks him. She gives him a kick in the butt that sends him, you know, into the wall. So there's your Me Too movement. So anyway, she yells, yo, get him. He's got the medallion. Da, 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 da. So that starts a little bit of a chase. And you've got the cops coming in on one side, and you've got the three villains on the other side. Lou's got one door. Bud's got the other door. And Bud's on three. Open the door. So Bud counts to three. They open the door, and both parties crash into each other, and Bud and Lou can escape with the medallion. Now, this leads to what I feel is the funniest part of the movie. And we talked about this in the last podcast, that they were starting to test material on the Colgate Comedy Hour in front of live audiences and then using the material in upcoming films. Now, they did it in Keystone Cops, with Bud being thrown, you know, being manhandled, you know, at the beginning of the film. That was done in their Christmas episode a few years earlier. And in this one, when they premiered Abbott and Costello Go to Mars, they pushed it on the Colgate Comedy Hour. The whole episode was about them trying to get to the premiere of Go to Mars. And during that episode, they do the necklace routine. They get this necklace that's, you know, cursed, and they have to get rid of it or whatever it is. And it ends up on one of their hamburgers, and Lou ends up eating it. And every time he bites down on the hamburger, you hear this sickening crunch sound. And it's one of the funniest things they ever did. In fact, I think it's the funniest thing they did on the Colgate Comedy Hour. And they just keep laughing, and they can't. Lou has his mouth full. He can't swallow all the stuff he has in his mouth. He has to spit it into the napkins, and it's just pandemonium, and it's very funny. So now they have their medallion, and they're sitting down. First, they go to a pawn shop to see if they can get some money for it. And we used to laugh about this when we were kids. Take it away! Take it away! It is bad! This guy just goes off because it's cursed. Mm-hmm. It has the curse of Clarice. And whoever holds on to it dies. But Bud and Lou don't know this yet. But they do run into Marie Windsor. Actually, she comes in and finds them there. And they make a deal. She's going to give them $5,000 for the medallion. Of course, she doesn't have it on her. So she's going to meet them at the Cafe Baghdad. And they're going to make the switch. So the boys show up at the Cafe Baghdad. First, Bud is planning how he's going to spend the money.
$5,000. Oh, boy. I'll have to figure this thing out. $5,000 will take us to the States. Now I got to figure the fare. Let's see, a first-class ticket for me, third-class ticket for you, a new suit of clothes for me. Of course, you'll have to have your shoes shine. Well, I'll have to buy some expensive gifts to take home to the folks. Well, you can send home a couple of postcards.
Yep, this is Bud to a T. So anyway, they sit down at the table at the Cafe Baghdad, and they want to know what the deal is with this medallion. And why did the pawn shop guy freak out? Why does she want to spend $5,000 for it? So they show it to the waiter, and the waiter also says, oh, it means death. It means death to whoever holds it. And he walks away, and Bud slips it into Lou's pocket, of course. Lou finds it there, and he puts it in Bud's pocket. Bud finds it there, and they put their hamburgers down, and Bud puts it on Lou's hamburger. And now we start the whole, I think that girl's very pretty, and they switch places, you know, bang, bang. No, that girl is much prettier, and they switch it back, and, you know, they keep ending up with the medallion in the hamburger. So finally, it ends up with Bud. They do the typical thing where Lou just makes the sound of switching the hamburgers, but it turns out that he didn't, and Bud ends up with the medallion. So he takes it and he puts it into this carafe that has ketchup in it, and Lou is laughing because he put one over on Bud, and he pours, you know, some ketchup on his hamburger. Picks it up, takes a bite, and it sounds like he's biting into like an anchor or an anvil. It is like, and it's so funny because every time he swallows, it sounds like somebody's dropping like coins into a tin box. It is just, it's so funny. It's so funny. So anyway, he has to eat this thing. And people will kill me if I don't mention that the girl who was selling him the flowers at the beginning of this bit was Lou's second daughter, Carol Costello. Very pretty. She was also in Keystone Cops. She was the girl at the movie theater. She sold him the ticket to get into the movie theater. Anyway, she's a very pretty girl and had a little bit of a career and ended up as the, I don't think they ever got married, but Dean Martin's son and she were a item for years. And she died very young, I think in 1986, of cancer. Anyway, that's a shame. So anyway, they do this wonderful routine at the Cafe Baghdad. And it's just, I don't know, it's just so beautifully done. It's such a great routine. And the ending is just fantastic. So anyway, Lou swallows the medallion. Now, this made me think, because later in the next scene is done with an X-ray machine, because they want to see the medallion inside Lou's stomach. And I'm thinking, he just bit this thing into 80 different bites. You know, how are they going to see this? But when you look at the, I'm going to say fluoroscope, but that's what they called it then. When you looked at the X-ray, you see the full medallion, but the chain is like an inch long, where it was normally a normal chain. So he actually ate the chain and not the medallion itself. So here I am trying to make sense of this. But this starts a very funny scene where they're trying to, first of all, she tells the doctor, when they get to this doctor's office to make sure that they can look into Lou's stomach, she tells the doctor, I was a nurse in my past and I know how to use an X-ray machine or a fluoroscope and I can do this. So anyway, they have to keep shaking Lou up in order to get the proper angle on the medallion so they could read what it says. And Bud gets involved and they end up throwing Lou up through the ceiling, halfway through the ceiling with his legs dangling down. Vic Parks said that that was a very difficult stunt to do, believe it or not. There were two people above that were supposed to grab him. And the first time it didn't work, he fell. Yeah. Ooh. Second time they got him. So yeah, they're there just to get the medallion and find out how to get to Princess Aura and dig up the treasure. Okay, Richard Deacon is introduced here. Mel Cooley, Fred Rutherford.
Yep,
Richard Deacon. Now, how many of us did not grow up with Richard Deacon, the great Richard Deacon, wearing that stupid hat? In this movie, he looks like the Pope. You know, if the Pope were an anal retentive, uptight person, I think it would be Richard Deacon in that hat. And we meet him first. He's watching a actually pretty good dance. I don't know about you, but I wasn't bored by the dances in this. They were very good. And when they do the arm thing, when they get behind him, and there's like 6-7 arms dancing behind him, I thought that was great.
Yep.
So let's talk about Richard Deacon, born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1922. He went to Ithaca College in upstate New York and Bennington College. His family moved to Binghamton, New York, a town I'm very familiar with because a lot of my friends went to college there. He worked as an orderly at that time at the General Hospital, wanting to get into a medical career. He also, in World War II, got into the medical corps. And when he came back, he finished up his education at Bennington College and got into performing. He was also a gourmet chef, by the way, and was the first person I ever noticed using a microwave. I remember his appearance on the Dinah Shore Show in the 1970s, before anyone knew what a microwave was. And he introduced this new product, and he had cookbooks that went along with it, and he had a show... Huh. A microwave cooking show in Canada on the CBC. Nobody knows that. Then he's, oh, Dick Van Dyke. But anyway, he got into theater and eventually got into movies in 1953 with these three classic sci-fi movies. He had very small uncredited roles in Invaders from Mars, Them, and This Island Earth. I mean, three really good 50s sci-fi movies. Yeah. His first on-screen credit was a little movie called Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. This was his first on-screen credit. His last on-screen credit, one was The Happy Hooker Goes to Hollywood in 1980, and then eventually a teen comedy called Bad Manners in 1984. It just gives you an idea of the dumbing down of our culture as it went on into the 80s. Yeah. On TV, he was mostly known for Leave It to Beaver for 6 seasons. And he was on it at the same time that he was on The Dick Van Dyke Show. How about that? So from 1957 to 1963, he was Fred Rutherford, the father of Lumpy Rutherford, Lumpy, on Leave It to Beaver. And then he was on The Dick Van Dyke Show as Mel Cooley, Alan Brady's brother-in-law. and the show runner, I guess you'd call him, or producer. And he was very funny in that, and especially playing against Maury Amsterdam, who just tore him a new one every week. Yes. He also was on a show called The Mothers-in-Law, which we mentioned, and he did actually only the second season. He replaced Roger C. Carmel, who was the original Roger in The Mothers-in-Law, and that was a Desilu production. He was a closeted gay man. He never came out, and he had a very, very private life. The closest he got to us was his cooking. He always felt that, I read this in an interview with him, that he always felt bad that his character was always so disagreeable, because that's not him in real life. And he always felt like he was misrepresenting himself. So, you know, that's I felt kind of some empathy for him there. He passed away at a very young age in 1984. He was only 62 years old. That's terrible. 62. It's like he didn't live. He missed the last chapter, you know? The book ended early.
Yeah.
So that's Richard Deacon, a favorite of all of us, I'm sure. And he is the head of the cult that wants to keep Clarice pure and want to keep the infidels away from Princess Ara and the treasure and all that stuff. Now, at this point, all of a sudden, Peggy King shows up to sing a song. Now, this reminds me of an earlier time when all of a sudden, you know, the Andrews sisters would show up and do a song, or Martha Ray would all of a sudden start singing. This is Peggy King, and she was very popular. If you look at the movie posters from the time, and I just want to say that Universal spent the least amount of money that year in advertising for this movie. The least for this movie. Now, I wonder why Abbott and Costello decided to leave Universal. I don't blame them at all. Yeah. But anyway, Peggy King, very fascinating. And it's a good song. It's a standard. You Came a Long Way from St. Louis. Really good song. And she's a terrific singer. It's just weird that she pops up here. So she gets this little square on the bottom of the posters of the advertisements saying, Pretty Peggy King, Pretty Peggy King, George Gobel's TV girlfriend. And that's just what she was. She was born in Greenburg, Pennsylvania. Greenburg, Pennsylvania. Never heard of it. In 1930. She sang with bands as a young girl. She sang with Charlie Spivak's band and Ralph Flanagan and Ray Anthony, who's still alive. I think he's 100. In 1952 at MGM, she sang a song for The Bad and the Beautiful. I believe it was the theme song for the movie. And she did the vocals for Hunt's Tomato Sauce commercials. That was her voice singing along. And those commercials, now this is a lesson, you actors out there. Mitch Miller heard one of those commercials, sought her out, and signed her to a long contract at Columbia Records. And she was voted Best New Singer by Billboard and Downbeat magazines in 55, 56. So she was no slouch. Wow. You know, she was not an unknown that just, you know, they pointed the camera at. Her last album was in 2016, after 36 years of not recording. And it did pretty well. She's in movies. She's in the movie that inspired Airplane, Zero Hour, from 1957. She was the stewardess in that. I could say stewardess because it's an old movie. Mm-hmm. And let's see, she once had a relationship with Sammy Davis Jr., from what I understand. She was married three times. And speaking of marriage, she was on the George Gobel show from 54 to 57. And she was Pretty Perky Peggy King. George Gobel was probably best known for his appearance on the Johnny Carson show when he said, what was that?
Do you ever feel like the whole world is a tuxedo and you are a pair of brown shoes?
And that was one of the anniversary shows and everybody was wearing tuxes. Yeah. And that was the night that Dean Martin was flicking ashes into his drink and onto his shoulders. But anyway, that was a lot of fun. So, you know, Richard Deacon was a very young man. He was like in his early 30s when he made this movie. And it was supposed to be H.B. Warner playing that part, who was like 80 at the time. Mm. And he either turned it down or he couldn't get insured. He was too old. I don't know what it was. But when Lou offered the anti-communism paper to sign to Richard Deacon, Richard Deacon said, no, I refuse to sign it. And when he told people about this on the set, they said, oh my God, you're never going to work at Universal again. Forget it. Lou's going to tell the front office and that's it. You're dead. Lou never mentioned it. Lou never thought about it. It was like, forget it. It was all over. I think he saw the error of his ways at this point. So nothing happened to Deacon and he worked at Universal forever. So I was happy to hear that. At least, you know, Lou came around, right? Yeah. Okay, so this is where I'm going to speed things up because now it becomes Three Mummies. for some reason, I never quite got this, but they were going to steal Clarice's body and they wrapped up Michael and Sarah so he would replace Clarice in the sarcophagus so the people would think it was him. It's so stupid, but it really doesn't matter. Bud gets the same idea. I don't know where they get these bandages from. You know, it's like, well, we've got to bring these bandages. So Bud gets the same idea. I'm going to wrap myself up in it. So you've got three mummies. But first, there's another dialogue scene, another tribute to John Grant, and probably the most famous one from this film. And it has to do with entrenchment tools.
This looks like a soft spot to dig. Oh, here, I'll help you. Give me one of those implements.
Here, take your pick. There. Wait a minute, hold on. That's a shovel. Here's the pick over here.
Well, I picked the shovel. The shovel is my pick.
Oh, no, this is a pick. This is a shovel.
That's what I picked is a shovel.
How can a shovel be the pick?
Look, if I'd have wanted a pick, I'd have picked the pick. But instead, I picked the shovel because the shovel is my pick.
Oh, in other words, you don't want to pick the pick because the pick is a pick and the shovel isn't a pick. If you pick the pick, the shovel isn't a pick.
Now you've got it.
Now I got it. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
You still don't understand, do you?
No.
Here, look. Here, now you take your pick. There you are. Now the pick is your pick.
Let's try it again.
Now what?
Now come on, you take your pick. You took the shovel! Here's the pick over here!
All right, please, come on, dig a hole here. We're in enough trouble as it is, Lou. I think
you're all in. So the shovel is my pick. So here's another human interest thing. Richard Deacon was very claustrophobic. And in the movie, they tie him up, the villains tie him up and put him into this little hole. It's not even a little hole. It's like a 6-foot thing. And they have to put a tarp over him to hide him. Lou overheard that he was claustrophobic. And Lou went to Charlie Lamont and said, all right, do this, throw the thing over it and take it off immediately. You know, yell cut, take it off immediately. If you have to cut to another shot, cut to another shot, but get him out of there as soon as possible. Lou took care of him. And this is the guy who didn't sign his communist thing. I don't know. I just love that story. I also failed to mention Viola Vaughn, who was the attractive brunette in the restaurant scene that is insulted when Lou speaks to her. And of course, when she's insulted, she tells him in a very broad French accent, her name, her phone number, her address, when she's home, you know, all of these things inadvertently. Then she starts speaking French. And Bud and Lou do an old familiar routine here.
Now, lady!
How dare you try to make a date with me? I work in a cafe. I do my act. Nobody makes a date with me. I finish my act. So you think you're going to make a date with me, huh? You think I tell you I live at 4242 54 Ruelle Favre, apartment 2B? You think I'm going to tell you I am not married, I live by myself, and that my phone number is 2341-648? Oh, just because I work in a cafe, I do my act. Mais c'est important! J'espère que vous ne me prenez pas stupide, parce que je suis une pauvre petite femme qui a besoin de travailler pour gagner son pain. Oh, mais vous n'avez pas besoin d'être si insolente avec moi. And if you dare to follow me home, here's my card.
Hey, wait a minute, what is this all about?
Oh, j'espère que vous ne prenez pas stupide, monsieur.
Oh, no, lady, I don't think I can.
No, monsieur, j'espère que vous ne prenez pas stupide.
No, lady, I can't.
Oh, je suis une pauvre petite femme qui a besoin de travailler pour gagner son pain.
No, lady, I don't think I can.
Yeah, but what's she saying? Maybe I can.
Now, Viola Vaughn was a very attractive lady, and she was on their radio show quite a bit. In fact, she was a regular on their ABC show for their last 2 years, their last two seasons. And she was, Jack Benny liked her too, liked using her as well. And he said quite famously, she's the only woman on radio who sounds like she's not wearing any clothes. So she had this kind of a reputation. And she comes back in 30 Foot Bride of Candy Rock as that kind of character, as a kind of slutty, attractive, curvy woman. Okay, so we've got the three mummies running around. One of the funniest gags in the movie is when Marie Windsor, who has a gun in her hand, sees the three mummies walk in, and she says, "Wait a minute, which one of you is Charlie?" And all three raise their hands, including Clarice. Now, this leads us to a kind of a weird ending. Clarice actually starts to attack Marie Windsor, who's shooting at him with the gun until it's empty, and she does the Superman gun throw. You know, whenever a villain had an empty gun, he'd always throw it at Superman, which I always thought was like, what a waste of energy. Are you kidding? He just took 90 bullets in his body and nothing happened, and you're going to throw a gun at him? I don't get it, you see. So anyway, Jack Benny, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, bud. Quiet, what is with you? Get out of here. I'm going to get Don Wilson on. I don't know where I'm going with this. But anyway, so she is attacked, and they have dynamite. There's dynamite there. They were going to use it to find the treasure and blah, blah, blah. So the whole thing starts with, throwing the dynamite. Lou doesn't know what it is, and he's holding on to it. He throws it to Bud. Bud throws it back to him. The thing is, Dan Seymour's character, when he sees the three mummies, he faints. And he's down on the floor there by the sarcophagus. And Clarice is there now. And Lou throws the dynamite to Clarice, who catches it. And he's holding on to it. And it explodes, and it blows up that entire area. And I'm just thinking, poor Dan Seymour. he was in a faint. He was just laying there, and he had to be blown to bits. But I guess, they're all killers, Here's what happens. They blow up the mummy. They blow up the sarcophagus, that whole thing. And Bud gets the idea that they could take the money from the treasury and open up the Cafe Clarice, a nightclub, and they have a full orchestra and everything else. Richard Deacon is the maitre d'. I don't know why he got a pass, because he was just as deadly as the villain. He was ready to kill everybody. But poor Dan Seymour, he's in seven different pieces, and I don't see Marie Windsor anywhere, or Michael Ansara.
No.
So anyway, Bud and Lou are the owners, and they do another gag from the Colgate Comedy Hour. And that's when Lou doesn't have a tuxedo and he puts on a one-piece tuxedo with a zipper. And it's a great gag. It really is a great gag. It got copious applause on the Colgate Comedy Hour. And so they do the last of what had been a running gag throughout the picture. Whenever Lou plays the little flute or whatever you would call it, a recorder? I don't know. A snake always comes up and scares him. So he asked Bud if he knows how to use it, and Bud says, "Certainly," and almost Oliver Hardy-like, and he starts playing it. It's funny that they both know how to play it. They are both expert long thing players, and so Bud is playing, and all of a sudden, a snake comes out, and then another snake comes out, and Lou looks at us and says, in pantomime, two, and it turns out to be the arms of a beautiful blonde, who wraps herself around Bud and gives him the kiss he's been waiting for 15 years. Lou always gets the girls in the movies. So anyway, he gets a wonderful kiss, and Lou decides, "Whoa, this is great. I'm going to do it too." And he goes over to the side, and he does do, 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 do. And this, of course, the worst snake you could possibly imagine. It looks like a crocodile, actually. And he sees it, and in fast motion, he goes running, and he crashes through this big glass partition, and it's a big mess, and that's the end. And I find it very interesting that the very last shot of their very last Universal film was Vic Parks and not Lou Costello. So there you go. That was quite a stunt. Lou, there's no way he would have done it. But interesting, it's like that's how they ended. I know I'm leaving out some stuff, but we'll leave that to the people who write to us. I'm sure I'll be hearing about the stuff that I missed. But that's basically the crux of the movie. And I have to say that the boys are in their last film. They are back in form. And they are just great. They're having a good time again. They're having fun. They're doing their crosstalk routines. And they're mixing it with some great slapstick. So I have no complaints about this, their final Universal film. Now, Jerry, I'm going to hand it over to you, as I do every time. And I want to hear your opinion.
Well, I also agree that it is a marvelous film. Before we started recording, we were chatting about this, you know, placing it. And I had said at that time that I really like it. I don't know that I'd put it in my top 10, but I really like it. Well, it must be you. Because now I'm thinking, you know, yeah, this could be in my top 10.
Yay!
Yeah. It, you know, maybe, you know, 7, 8, 9, yeah, somewhere in there, but still in the top 10. Because, yeah, it's a marvelous film. And as you say, what makes it is that they are having a great time doing it. I got to say, the biggest surprise I had was when the final credits rolled and it says Bud Abbott, Pete Peterson, Lou Costello, you know,
Ernie
whatever
Francis
his name
or
was.
Something.
Yeah. And I'm like, what?
Now, I just love the fact that they threw that out. They just ignored it, you know?
Yeah.
And nobody made a big deal about it. And it really didn't matter.
No.
It really didn't matter. I liked hearing Hey Abbott.
And it was,
you know?
Yes, it was rather fitting that in their final movie, you know, they start by just referring to each other as Bud and Lou, but then at that moment we get that really nice Hey Abbott. It's like, oh.
We're home. We're home. I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. And it's funny, you would think that this would not be a good movie. You know, there being their last movie at the studio, you would think that they would like slough it off, you know, kind of like what they did with Jekyll and Hyde. And more notoriously in Lost in Alaska. I have to amend something I said in the last episode. I said that or in the Dr. Jekyll episode, I said that that was my least favorite of their films. No, I made a mistake. It was Lost in Alaska. That's my least favorite. Jekyll and Hyde may be my second least favorite of their films. But this, it's not far away from those films. And look at it. Look at the product. When everybody was trying, when everybody was putting in an effort, you can't go wrong, you know? Now, my only thing, the indications that this was the end, I have to say, I'm sorry, but Bud, number one, was almost as heavy as Lou in this movie.
Yeah.
He was kind of slurry. He seemed older than his years. And I'm watching them and I'm thinking, no, they don't have a future. They don't have a future unless they made this drastic change, which eventually happened. You know, Lou going off on a solo career, which is what he wanted to do. He said in interviews, we've done everything. Where else are we going to go? You know, they ended up in Australia because there were no gigs here. Colgate ended in 1955. They did their last Colgate show. Their TV show had stopped filming a year ago. They no longer had a contract at Universal. So what did they do? They got on a plane or a ship. I don't know how they got there, but they ended up touring Australia, which is what a lot of British comedians did when things dried up in their own country. So there really weren't that many places left to go. Their swan song was Las Vegas eventually, but they had one more movie in them. And I have to say that, you know, a lot of people are real wise guys about this movie. They just look at it and they automatically think it's like Laurel and Hardy's last movie, Atoll K, you know, even Chaplin's last movie, Countess from Hong Kong, or the crap Keaton did, you know, at the end. But it was nothing like that. It's actually quite a good film if you take the time to look at it and actually see what they were trying to do. And that movie is their final film together, Dance With Me, Henry, which was, I think, maybe the last movie I had to see of theirs when they started showing it on Sunday mornings in New York. I had no idea, you know, what it was or whatever, Dance With Me, Henry. But it also, it has an interesting background, has an interesting story, and we're going to get to it in our next episode. Now, yes. I am in Louisville, Kentucky. Did I mention what I'm doing here?
You did.
I think I did.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I did. So our next, and this is for you, Jerry. I will be here for 3 weeks, but I think I'm going to be home mm-hmm. by the time we record our next episode. We do the Dance With Me, Henry episode. So that should okay. be okay. And in the yeah. meantime, I just want to say congratulations on getting cast in a national tour. And there are a few things better in show business. I love touring. Yeah. I love it. So you're going to be playing different theaters, meeting different people, different audiences, and I'm just thrilled for you, Jerry. Congratulations.
I thank you very much for that, and I turn it right around back to you. This sounds like a great gig. You're going to begin tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I wish you all the best on that
as well.
Thank
you very much. So look at us. Look at us, huh? Huh, guys? You're not messing around with the amateurs here, you know? You know what I'm saying? So we will see you next time when we talk about their final film together. It's kind of sad when you think about it, but this is their final film together. And Bud, like their first film, does not have a mustache in this one. So we'll discuss that when we get to Dance With Me, Henry. Take care, everyone. Stay healthy. And we will see you next time.